What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, SPATS 2016. We're down here in South Padre at the South Padre Athletic Trainer Seminar. Thanks for bringing me out here, allowing me to do this conference record. Here I have Missy Frazier. She just recently accepted a job at Texas State University in San Marcos. So she will be working at Texas State in San Marcos. And what is your title there?
I will be an assistant professor in the athletic training program.
Assistant professor in athletic training. And some of her research that she's working on is dealing with concussions and specifically with football and impacts and how, you know, research all these little different factors work in. And so give me a brief overview of your session, and then I'm going to ask you some specific questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I was speaking about are how emotion dysregulation, so specifically depression, anxiety, aggression, and impulsivity, are different or exist prior to people's participation in sport, and how it's divided up in different groups, and then how impact biomechanics can positively or negatively play in or is associated with some of these different emotion dysregulation measures that we're looking at.
All right, so can you, obviously, as athletic trainers, we know what the impact test is.
Mm-hmm.
What test do you use for the emotional factors?
Yeah, absolutely. No, great question. So most of these are done in psychology, so with psychological measures. And what I've been using for aggression is the Bus Perry Aggression Questionnaire, also known as the BPAC. And then for impulsivity, I've used the Barrett Impulsivity Scale 11. So it's just an 11-question measure that really looks at generalized impulsivity. For anxiety, the Generalized Anxiety Disorder Scale 7. And then the Patient Health Questionnaire 9 is my depression measure. And then I've also started incorporating the Perceived Stress Scale 4. So one of the things that everybody probably listening and yourself know about athletes or youth in general, their attention span is not exceptionally long.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certainly longer, more intense measures that really give you these ideas, but you want to try to keep your measures as short as possible. So that's kind of why I chose these, and they also have been used in youth athletes, and they also can follow them up through adulthood. So if you only use adolescent measures, they don't always correlate so well with the adult measures. So being able to use these is helpful because you can follow them over time and really look at changes as they go through their maturation, as well as they have continued exposure to sport over time.
Okay, so you just listed off about like five, I think it was about five tests.
Yeah.
What does a normal session, so I'm going to come in, I'm going to be part of this study for you. So am I going to sit here for 5 hours while I go through these tests, or is it, you know, one visit I do one test, one visit another? How does that look like?
You do all of them in less than 15 minutes. Yeah, so that's what I mean. I try to keep it really, really brief. And this, in 15 minutes, it includes their past concussion history, their sport exposure, so the type of sport they're playing, how long they've played it, if they've had a concussion before, and a lot of specific information about those types of concussions and when they occurred. And so the measures themselves, just those five emotion dysregulation measures that you mentioned or I talked about, really only take maybe 7 or 8 minutes in total for them to complete. And that's what I mean. Like, I really try to keep them as brief as possible. Because if I had every single kid come in and I told them I'm going to have to spend a half a day doing this, I would have no participants.
Right.
So, and two, if we're going to talk about clinicians starting to employ this as athletic trainers and how they can maybe help benefit athletic trainers and coaches and parents, again, you don't want something that's going to take hours and hours. Most athletic trainers are already really time crunched as it is. And I've also managed to use, most people know what SurveyMonkey is, I think. My mode that I use is Qualtrics, which is very similar. So I can actually email the questionnaires to individuals, and they can do it on their own time, on their phone, or on their computers, or you can bring them in and have them complete them on huge banks of computers all at once. So you could test however many people at the exact same time. So it doesn't have to be one-on-one. And a lot of research has shown when you're talking about emotion dysregulation or psychological things that maybe are sensitive, if you do one-on-one questioning, especially with youth, they potentially aren't going to be as honest, because who wants to tell somebody outright that I'm really aggressive, or I'm really anxious, or I'm really depressed. So their scores might really change. But if you allow them to answer the questions on their own, oftentimes their scores will much more closely reflect what their true moods and behaviors are. So that time perspective, but also to get much closer to their scores, I think that this is a much better mechanism.
All right, so in there you mentioned people can get a hold of you. We got plenty more questions, and we're going to mention this again at the end, but go ahead and say right now, what's the best way for somebody to get a hold of you if they want to bring this to their school or they're interested in finding out more?
Yeah, so right now, as you said, I'm about to move to Texas State, and my email at Texas State is just my name, very easy. It's just Missy, M-I-S-S-Y, Fraser, F-R-A-S-E-R, at txstate.edu. I could give you my UNC email address, but since it'll only be active for about another month and a half to 2 months, it probably wouldn't help very much. But right. I can answer my Texas State email right now. And yeah, I'm very interested in coming here to Texas and starting to incorporate this in schools across the area. One of the things with concussion that nobody's really looked at are how race and cultural differences really play into concussion symptoms and reporting and outcomes. And so, you know, here in the Valley, obviously, compared to, say, North Carolina, where I've been, there's a very different set of individuals who are playing sports. And, you know, the culture that they've been raised in, if you want to divide it into race, they're very different. And so kind of looking at how we can look at these differences, I think, would be really important, because while we talk about generalizability of our results, nobody's looked at, honestly, how generalizable they are to everybody. And I think that's something that would be really interesting, because there are some cultural differences in anxiety, depression, impulsivity, and then also in people's willingness to report symptoms or concussion or just injuries in general, and how you respond to them.
So along that same lines, the scales and tests that you're using, how have you tested them to make sure that they're accurate for Spanish speakers?
So there are, what I use have only been English, but there are, I mean, they've been used in Japan, they are translated to every single speech, language, culture. I mean, you go all over and you can use it anywhere, which it makes it really helpful for people in their interpretation. So I think that, yeah, and I think in coming here, that's something that I would really want to look at, because even in North Carolina, there were some people that we had to exclude from the study because we only had them written in English.
Yeah.
But certainly coming here, we would make sure that they could select multiple, because we had kids that had come from various Pacific Islands, and we didn't have translations for those either, so they also had to be excluded. So I think looking at how we can, kind of like how impact you can hit what language you predominantly speak, hopefully we can do that where somebody would open their email, or we would do it in a classroom or a training room, and you could say, I speak Hindu, and it would, all your questions would come out in Hindu, instead of just come out necessarily always in English. So that way we can really be very cross-cultural in this type of research and being able to help all athletes and all people.
Gotcha. Also, welcome to the broadcast, Robbie McFarland.
I had to get in on this one, man.
Former student of Dr. Missy.
Now, when I'm
Fraser.
Talking student, literally, I was her only student in her sports medicine one class there at there in college. Like, I'm sitting at the table, dude. I'm talking, like, I'm trying to keep my eyes open because I'm coming off the road of basketball. I'm dog tired, and I text her, you know, do I still have to come to class? It's 2 a.m. We just got home, and yep. I'll be there. Like, how do you hide in that situation? You don't. You're the only one. And I was the only freshman in the program that year. Remember, I told you that we did the spotlight a couple weeks ago. Only freshman in the program. We were low on athletic trainers that year anyways, right? And so, I mean, there's no hiding. You're not, you know, sleeping in the tape closet. Where's the freshman at? Today.
Yeah.
Oh, grown man.
He will always be freshman. But I will have to say, to point out to this story, he's whining because he was up until 2. I was still up at 2, or woke up at 2, and he would text me to answer his question. So I also
this is,
had a
this
crazy
is true.
Schedule.
This is true. And we come from, are we not products of our upbringing?
I'm sorry.
just knowing Missy, and we've been friends for a long time. We weren't friends like for a couple of times. But one time she made me roll the field. I was not very happy. But that was the only time I would say we weren't friends. But product of our upbringing, she comes from the Midwest. She comes from a hardworking, hard-nosed family. They taught her right. Hard-nosed, hardworking, all across the board. I've seen her put up with more than most of us could and continue to do that despite the fact that I've got to get all these rehabs done. I've got to get all these class notes done for my one student. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I feel very special.
My pleasure.
And she would grind all that out, and then we'd, you know, she'd be in the office. Hey, Missy, what's up? Oh, sorry. I'm just catching a nap. Didn't get any sleep. My goodness. But then she takes that. You kind of cut your teeth. You have those times in your life where it's just rough, and you're like, I don't know if I'm ever going to make it out alive. Then you do, and then you take that work ethic to North Carolina, and you bless them with your presence, but you came back to Texas. Thank you.
So
but
excited
you go
to
out there
back
and you
Texas.
Take, yeah, exactly. We're very excited as well. But you take that work ethic, and it that inherently is a foundation of this because what you do, you have to have that. I mean, you don't want to do it, but you got to get it done. And then the drive, the heart of the matter is she wants to help athletes. She always has. And when she goes out and does that, that's an inspiration to me, even in a high school setting, that, you know, she's passionate about this. We need to be passionate about this. And that always translated in her notes and everything to us, just being her student for 5 years. It was 5 years. At least it wasn't 9. I know somebody that took 9.
True.
But that passion, and that's why I like it when she speaks in situations like this. It's she translates that passion to us. And I'm a product of that passion. I'm a product of her wanting us to know this and why. The why is the big deal to me. What are we trying to do? How do we want to make this better? I'll come in and tell her, yep, I think that thrower's got a grade 2 ankle sprain. She's like, what ligament, what happened? She wants to know everything. And the why was always a big deal. And I like that. I appreciate that. Because now I get it. I didn't get it back then. Like, just write it down. I know what it is. Are you thorough? So thorough. That's a great job. I think what she's fixing to do here in Texas, we are huge beneficiaries of it. And I say in the high school setting, speaking for you and I, and just for the athletes, and that's the why, is it not? She loves her athletes, man. I think she loves them more than us as her student trainers, but,
sometimes.
You know, that's, yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
No,
but, no, we're
sweet.
You're sitting here. This is a golden opportunity for us. We got lucky, Texas. We got lucky. She's back.
Very complimentary, Robbie. I appreciate that.
Look, and no grades are on the line. I want it
That's
for the
true.
Record. No grades are on the line. I've already graduated, so I did this actually from my heart. You know,
I got restarted.
Yeah.
All right. So, in your presentation, you talked about anxiety is higher in no contact sports.
Yes.
Talk a little bit more about that.
So, the non-contact athletes were track and field, golf, tennis, and swimming. Men's and women's in both are all the sports. And one of the things, and again, I think when we look at these contact level differences, and one of the things that I'm really interested in is starting to expand our research and getting into grade schools prior to people ever participating in sports. And whether you're an athlete or not, having them fill out very similar measures and then following them over time. So maybe once a year, you follow them and you see, are you in sports? Are you not in sports? And then do these measures change? So kind of like how I was talking about, is the environment what changes things? Or were some of these people already prior to participating in sport? Were they higher in anxiety or depression or aggression? You know, what is the mechanism that drives these? And so right now, I can't say for certainty with my data what this is, but I really think in my own mind that people, based upon their own personalities, are going to be drawn to specific sports. Now, do some people get pushed into those sports because of parents, potentially?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I've seen my fair share of kids who are playing sports that really don't want to be there, and they're there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, if you have a certain set point and a certain mood state or behaviors, that you're going to be drawn to specific sports. But in my mind, participation, continued participation in your sports, is going to alter what you already had as your set point to begin with. So if you play in a really aggressive sport, and not that you just play, say, football or ice hockey or wrestle, but that you have a coach that continues to push the aggression level. And, you know, I'm sure you all played sports, and some people have a very different disposition than others. They have very different coaching styles. So depending upon the types of coaches and your parents and the media and your teammates, you know, depending upon the environment that you're around, you may see these change more or less depending upon you, how you're going to absorb those things, and then how these people are going to respond to you as well. So I think that it's a very multidimensional.
Is it not the class scenario I just explained, though? I mean, because I had nowhere to hide. And it's funny how we go to this question next, and then it brings up the point of you're an individual, you're one-on-one, versus you can kind of hide if you're an offensive guard, and you kind of hide amongst the other 10 on the field with you, whereas track, you're in the spotlight. Swimming, you're in the spotlight. Yeah. It's you and the guy next to you, and everybody's watching. And that I can see it's me and missing in class, and the anxiety's on me. You know, she doesn't get to yell at other kids if they fail. It's just me. And that makes a lot of sense. There's more anxiety involved with that because you're in the spotlight. Yeah. And if there's anything I know from the high school setting, we are more and more a society of people that can't handle that spotlight eye on you. It's on you. It's always wanting to put it on somebody else. It's hard to take that personally. That anxiety as well is more. You want to blame it. Oh, my shoe wasn't tied. The person next to me threw a rock at me while they were running. No, it's you. That's a big problem. And the anxiety thing, one-on-one, that makes a lot of sense. Been there, done that.
Yeah. And some people really, they can't handle that. And so they end up not being in those sports. I mean, some people only play team sports. Mm-hmm. That's all you will ever see them play. And other people can kind of ebb and flow and change depending upon their likes and
some people just like
exposure.
To be track athletes.
Yeah.
I mean, they are like superstar. Think they're the best. Like, dude, you're JV, you know, B team track. But, yeah, keep running, bro.
All right, so you said you want to get into grade school longevity studies. That would be awesome. But I think, you know, my son, he's a kindergartner.
Yeah.
He reads really well.
Mm-hmm.
But some of his classmates don't read so well. So how would you translate that same test for anxiety and depression for me as you would to those kids?
Right. So there are different measures that you can use for adolescents and for younger than that still. So there are kids who are in fifth grade. There are kids that are 5 years old. And some of them have anxiety. There are people that are 25 and 50 that have it. And certainly, you know, I kind of equate it to this. If you go to the doctor at your age, he says or she says, what is your pain on the scale? And they would either give you the 0 to 6 or the 0 to 10, right? And you're expected, without any help, to tell her what it is. If you take your son, what do? They have the little list
smiley
that has
faces.
The smiley faces on it, right? And they say, which smiley face most represents how you're feeling?
Which emoji now,
yeah,
2016? Which emoji?
Sticker. I think they're called stickers now. That's the new, they're stickers.
That's the thing, okay.
That's what Emma calls it. She's 8. So.
We're learning.
Yeah. So there are ways, like we can translate these measures to even younger individuals who, you know, don't have that same cognitive capacity as an older individual. Uh-huh. And truly, even some of the measures that I use now, I had to change some of the terminology and some of the questions to make them apply more directly to youth. Things that I don't think about, and I'm struggling right now off the top of my head to think of some of them that I had to change.
I'll tell you right now, if you ever take one of her tests, she's using all these big words and everything. Well, you should know that. It was in the book. Well, I couldn't read it in the book, and I can't read it on the test. Like, she comes straight off her dome, and some. I this makes a lot of sense, the whole translation
thing.
For you,
though, I understand.
I'm not the best person to have on this interview. I'm sorry. I've got too much insight.
No, but there are ways that we can translate it, same as how we can translate it to another language. We can translate it to be appropriate for younger individuals. And, you know, if you have somebody read a question and they're 85 versus 40 versus, mm-hmm. you know, 22 versus 8, the same question might mean very different things to those people. And so making sure that the terminology applies to that age group. And I only figured this out by giving these questionnaires to multiple different age groups and being like, oh,
there's
the way
a lot
that
of
you're
learning
reading
on the
it
run.
Is no way. Yeah. Like, I never would have thought about it in that way, but how they're raised is, it's been a learning experience. Very positive, but mm-hmm. I've really had to look at things from a much more broad perspective in thinking about those. And as you were saying with the translation to other languages, making sure that it appropriately translates is certainly important. And one of the ways, I mean, they've already been translated, but that's something to think about. You know, as you go into younger people or older people as well, how that would work. Yeah.
All right. So another thing you said, impact length. Like the shorter the length of the impact, mm-hmm. the less the G-force or there's something along those lines.
Yeah.
And so it's two parts. One, can you explain that a little bit more? And then two, what recommendations or what ways can we reduce that length?
So the duration or the length of the impact plays into oftentimes the magnitude or how long the forces are being absorbed by the person's head, brain, whatever, right? So the goal is to make the impact duration be as short as possible. And so when I was talking about helmets, before, you know, you had the leather heads, like, way back in the day,
mm-hmm.
and those were soft leather, so when they would hit, they could almost, and when I say stick, I don't mean, like, Velcro and they hang out and they're just touching, right? But they didn't have that glancing effect, so as they went through and they were working on developing equipment, that's how the football helmet came out with this hard, very shiny sheen type of surface, so it's really slick, so when things hit, they go off. And if people have, you know, if you hit a face mask or if you get ruts torn in them, that they're supposed to get buffed out and refurbished and taken care of and repainted, right? The reason for that is specifically to help keep it so that way it doesn't have a lot of friction capacity to it. So that way they can still continue with that quick glancing, very short duration impact. So there's a couple products, particularly the Guardian out there, where it's kind of almost like putting the leather head over the top of your helmet. So basically, that the idea behind that was it would absorb the forces, but it also increases the duration of the impact. So because you have soft and soft hitting, so again, they're much more sticky. You don't have that glancing impact anymore. And so you can really actually increase the amount of forces that the individual is sustaining or absorbing in and around their brain. In addition to that, with helmets and anything, well, they also said that it actually negates the warranty on the helmets because you're changing the helmet. So technically by wearing them, anything that happens, the helmet company will no longer validate any of their warranties because you're changing the helmet.
Yeah.
So that's also something to keep in mind if you're going to put those on your helmets. But truly your brain is like an egg. And so if you think about an egg, and if you just hold the egg and you're really nice and light with it, and you open it up, the yolk is very separate, right? You have two parts. You have the white and the yellow. But if you take it in your hand and you drop it on the ground, or you shake it with a little mariachi in your hand as hard as you can, and you open it, it's basically a scrambled egg, even though you didn't do anything, technically to the outer shell part of it until the very end. Your brain is much the same. You can put padding around an egg, and you can drop it, and you can do all kinds of things, but if you open it up and it imparts a lot of force, it's still going to be a scrambled egg. It doesn't matter what you put around the outside of it, it's still going to be moving inside of that structure. Helmets are much the same. Helmets were made to decrease fractures and bleeds. Face masks were made to decrease the number of facial fractures and dental injuries and eye injuries. And so they weren't designed, none of those were designed to decrease concussion incidents. Has it decreased some? Absolutely. Have fatalities decreased? Absolutely. Helmets and face masks are fabulous and they do their job. But what we need to remember is there will never ever be a concussion-proof helmet or anything like that, because again, your brain, much like the yolk of an egg, is still suspended in your cerebral spinal fluid. So until we can find a way, we don't think this will ever be physically or physiologically possible to hold it in place inside our skull so it can never actually hit the inside of our skull or stretch the meninges or any of the nerves in there, the spinal cord as it attaches to the inferior portion of our brain, concussions will always exist. Same, seatbelts help prevent a lot of injuries in cars. You know, we've come up with so many things as we've become more and more technologically advanced, but we still have injuries occur. So the goal is to minimize the risk of injury, which is why I was saying, you know, maybe incorporating some of this in and helping coaches determine maybe who's at the greatest risk for high impact injuries and not having them partake in certain plays. You know, if you know somebody is going to be hitting at a much higher magnitude and potentially get hurt because of that, probably you shouldn't put them in a lot of long distance plays where they're going to run a greater risk of C-spine injury and head injury. And so using that to help minimize that, and then also using already the toolbox that people have from some of their baseline tools. And then as we continue, hopefully we can start to incorporate some of these emotion dysregulation measures in there to inform us with their recovery status. And then also when we're trying to determine the return to play status, and if it's really, truly safe, if they've gone back to their real normal self where they were prior to the injury. And I think, and almost all concussion researchers, I think right now will say, or hopefully they would all say, you know, what we have right now is much better than anything we've had in the past, but it's still not perfect. We have a long ways to go in order to really minimize the risk of multiple concussions and, you know, when is the right time to return an athlete and how many is too many and when can we hold them out? So maybe using some of these measures can help inform clinicians, you know, maybe when have we hit that cliff point where we're at the too many and we need to hold them out or maybe talk about retiring them, even at earlier ages now, just because we're seeing these gross change scores in athletes. And again, this is just the end part is more me saying this is hopefully where these predictive models that I'm working on are going to go.
Yeah.
And the more people I get in the studies and the more different types of groups and ages we get in, I think the more solid these models will be. But so far, they've been giving us some pretty good results. So we'll see what takes us.
All right. So I assume there's been some sort of sensors utilized,
yep.
Like the impact sensors or
yep.
The X2 biosystem or whatever, whichever one. Do those... I know the X2 goes behind your ear.
Correct.
Well,
the X2 patches. So
yeah,
X2 patches. Biosystems actually has several different
okay.
types, but the X2X patches go behind
so
your ear.
So that wouldn't affect the glancing aspect of the helmet at all, but do any of those sensors go onto the helmet, or they all fit onto the head or the inside of the helmet?
There are so many out there right now, and more come out all the time, so I couldn't speak to all of them. The HIT system, head impact telemetry system that we use at UNC and several of the other schools use, go inside the helmet. The goal is, and one of the reasons why the X2 patch from Biosystems is awesome is because it's actually attached to your head.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to really mimic what your head is doing and then what the brain inside of your skull is doing. And so far, obviously, you can't actually attach anything to the brain itself. Only in animal models can we do that. So it's difficult. They are, X2 is actually starting to no longer use the X2X patch anymore. But they are really focusing on the mouthpiece. There are, I think, some positives and negatives to mouthpieces. One, it's actually in your head. It's stationary. It's in there, and so as your head moves, hopefully it moves with it, unless you lose all your teeth. Although, if you've had athletes, as I have, you take them out and stick them in their helmet, or they spit them out, they get hit, and they go flying, which is something we've seen. And I kind of talked about this a little bit in my lecture, where almost half of our impacts actually didn't occur while the helmets were on their head during live play. You know, if a mouthpiece is bouncing down the field, that's the same as the helmet bouncing down the field without the person actually attached to it. So these are some of the things that as researchers and clinicians, we kind of need to keep in mind. I think the cool thing right now about a lot of the sensors, there's lots that are coming out. The pit system in itself, each accelerometer ranges between $1,200 and $1,500 per accelerometer, and that doesn't include the sideline mechanisms that you need. Most of the new accelerometers that are coming out are around $200 per accelerometer, which is, from a financial standpoint, awesome. And a lot of them, if you're talking about mouthpieces or headbands or some of these others, you can start doing research on or wearing them for sports that don't wear helmets, which is why I actually use the X2X patches on soccer players. And at UNC, we've been using that on lacrosse, soccer, field hockey, and football. But we're going to have to kind of move away from that since X2X patch is moving away from it. But one of the things that I would say before a high school or a junior high or club sport team wants to start purchasing these accelerometers are built for research purposes. There is no cut set point. So as I said in my lecture, you know, we lowered our threshold to 60 Gs when we looked at the high magnitude impacts for high, low, and moderate. For a reason, for high school, because it seems like that's, you know, at 60 Gs, we're not going to see as many impacts, and that's where normal concussions occur. But that threshold means nothing. So if you buy these sensors and you say, we need to check everybody that has an impact greater than 60 Gs, 99.8% of the time, they're not going to have a concussion. So you're going to be checking people and pulling them off whatever sport they're playing for no good reason. The other thing to keep in mind is we don't know for sure because how many teams have accelerometers? Not very many, especially in high school and below. Almost right. All of them are collegiate. Well, high school and below, like I said, these are where the brains are more vulnerable. So while from the research aspect, we haven't seen concussions occur below 58 Gs, the greater majority of sports teams that are even in colleges don't have accelerometers on their athletes for any sports, nonetheless football. So there could potentially be concussions that are occurring below that. And a lot of, they have like the stoplight, like red, you really need to check them, yellow, maybe green, they're fine. Well, the green is above 60, or it's below 60. So just because you're looking at these, red doesn't necessarily mean they have a concussion. So basically what you're going to see are people initially when they first buy these things, they're going to be like, I have to check them, it's red, and they're probably going to be fine most of the time. So people are going to quit paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. And then they won't check people who have a green light because, well, it's green, they should be fine, right? But they might actually be the kids that have the concussions. So when people buy these accelerometer systems, I think what they need to understand is these were designed currently for research to help us try to determine the mechanism of concussion, the magnitude of concussion, you know, what kind of plays into it. But they do not in any way, sense or form, help us diagnose concussions. We don't use them to diagnose concussions at all, ever. That's just not how we use them. I know that you can get pagers that go off with them. We do use them to look at the magnitude that the impacts occur, but we don't pull people off the field for specific magnitude impacts ever.
Very interesting. It's kind of like the BMI being based on a military population.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have a normal for, you know, Friday night types, right?
Right, absolutely. No. Yeah, no, I think that that's a great, great point. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, I've spoken to parents who are like, we're trying to raise money to buy these for our kids. And I'm like, just don't. Like, buy them new helmets, buy them shoulder pads that fit. Make sure, like, if you can, like, if you want to pay a dentist to come in and do molds and have fitted mouthpieces, put your money into that. Get them new cleats. Get whatever it is. Get a bus that runs all the time. pay your coaches. You know, whatever it is you need to do, but don't waste your money on accelerometers right now. Unless you're legitimately doing research, it's not going to help you in the way that you want it to help.
Okay, and then also in your talk, you said spearing is illegal as an action, but it's almost only flagged for defense. So to just to clarify that offense or defense, you should get a penalty for spearing.
Absolutely. That's how the rules are written.
Okay.
If you go and look at all the different levels of football and how the rules have been written, Spearing is actually the technique. It doesn't matter who is actually performing the technique.
Okay.
But the how in one of our earlier earlier speakers today was talking about dogma and how athletic trainers kind of follow what works and what we think. The same applies for officials and everybody else. They're like, oh, it is only defense and basically linebackers that should be flagged for spearing. But it's actually the action of lowering your head, flexing your neck, going into an impact willfully. And it's not about how they're going to hurt somebody else. The spearing rule was put into place to prevent people from breaking their own necks. So when the spearing rule was enacted, the number of fatalities as well as catastrophic injuries where people were paralyzed, either as quadriplegics or paraplegics, decreased dramatically from that because people were being penalized for playing with poor technique. And so that's the purpose of that rule. It doesn't matter whom is actually doing the action. It's that you're legitimately trying to break your own neck in the way that you're playing. So it's not trying to save your opponent. It's trying to save you.
Gotcha. All right. So one last time, Missy, yeah. Best way to contact you. I know you also had your Twitter up on there on the slide. That's Missy Frazier ATC.
Yes, correct.
All right. So on Twitter, are you on any other social media, Instagram, Snapchat, anything like that?
No, I'm boring and old, and I don't
But you're
do
on
this.
Twitter, so
I am. I am
on
Twitter, so yeah, so you can find me on there. And then, like I said, my email at Texas State will just be my name, so missyfrazier@txstate.edu. And I'll be moving back to Texas, which I'm so excited about, in the beginning of August. And, I'm about to become a Bobcat, so.
And this episode should be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/MissyFrazierSpats16. And, again, it'll be a little while before that gets released, because we'll have to edit and all that stuff. But I'll also have a link to that on that one to her presentation, so you can catch both of those if you catch this one first. So, Missy Frazier, welcome back to Texas, and thanks for joining us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I really appreciate it.